That college tango routine, I milked that all the way up through Erica. Whenever I'd like be at a party or something, and there'd be a girl I wanted to talk to, I'd be like, "Hey, would you like to tango? I know how."
Hey.
And they're always like, "Yeah, sure." All right, so Dan, take the prerequisite minute to soak in all the kitsch. I know.
Yes. Did you see the thing I sent over to you? It was like the Van Gogh style.
Yes, I liked it. The Star Night.
Wasn't that
Final Fantasy VII thing? Yeah, yeah. He always sends me Final Fantasy, like cool Final Fantasy VII artistic products.
And they never disappoint.
We actually ended up getting the you know, the record cutout. They take the vinyl and then they cut into shape.
Yeah, for the clock.
Eric, yep. I have one in the other room, but it's Star Wars.
Okay.
But you had sent me the Final Fantasy one.
I remember the Aerith scroll.
Yeah, and then the same. I think I had it in college too. The imported.
I don't think I saw that.
Oh yeah, that's the imported one from Japan.
Right on.
My graphic novel collection's grown a bit since college, but not like a crazy amount.
What did I? My sister got me the Tick run for my birthday.
Nice.
So Davey's at the age where he wants to read it with me, which is awesome. But it runs just a little bit darker.
I was gonna say, yeah, the comic's a bit much for a kid, right?
Well, there's some language, nothing terrible, but enough where, like, if I'm reading to him, I'll just skip over the words.
Nice.
Unfortunately, he can read, so.
Curses, my child's literate.
Yeah.
So what did you think of the new the Amazon one?
I've only seen the very first episode.
What?
I was.
Oh, dude, you gotta get on that.
I got so bad by the Patrick Warburton one.
Yeah.
That, like, a part of me was still scarred.
You will be. Your scars will heal.
Yep. I like it. I mean, what I saw was good.
It's very respectful.
It picks up much better after the first one because they redo the costume.
There's
and
a gag
looks
about it.
So
oh,
much nicer.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, the pilot, they do a one quick funny nod for a split second about that, and then they move on.
Nice.
Hi, we are Buddies in Space. You are?
That's Michael Smith, and you are?
And Michael Carassi, and you are?
Dan Saper.
All right. So, you guys like the drink?
I haven't even tried it yet. I'm waiting for this moment.
Mm-hmm. I think the extra ginger beer and less vodka helped.
Yeah, no. I'm a big fan of anything ginger-related.
Good.
So this is nice.
Let me send a bottle of ginger beer home with you. I'm not really doing sugar outside of this. So.
Yep. It's very refreshing.
Very.
You could almost mistake this for something healthy.
Well, I mean, given that it's, and actually it's funny you say that because that's part of the reason I chose it. Hmm. I tied your idea with that. Well, we'll get into that. Because this is a theme conversation guest episode. But yeah, there is so much grapefruit, fresh squeezed grapefruit, lemon, and lime juice that you can make that argument. And mint. A little bit of fiber if you chew it.
I will not.
Okay.
Throw some vitamin supplements in there. What is it? GNC?
Yeah. Dan, thank you for joining us, coming in from Buffalo by way of Geneseo.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
With your Geneseo State shirt on.
Absolutely.
So you just ditched your family, no car, left him in Geneseo and said, I'm going to go drink with my buddy?
They are stranded, but on the other hand, back in my day, I had no car in Geneseo and got by just fine.
We thought you had me. Oh, wait, my car never.
As long as we're on the air, we can now tell the story of Matt Britt and Joe O'Keefe's job proposition for
So, quick backstory for the listeners. So, Dan and I go way back to 99.
Yes.
We were freshmen at Geneseo together. We both kind of walked into the theater arts building and didn't come out until 4 years later when we graduated.
Mm-hmm.
It started with some other gentlemen under the improv troupe that I think is still going to this day.
Yeah.
No Laugh Track acquired.
So you're both students of Terry?
Terry Brown,
yeah.
Yes.
We both know Terry Brown, who's very well known in the acting circles of the local Rochester theater community. So we were taken under. So when we started, there were some seniors in the theater department, right?
Yes. There was a house, and our house became the heirs apparent.
Yes.
But a few names that you'll need to keep in mind, quick little shout out, Joe O'Keefe, Matt Britt, Matt Martin, J. Michael Zygo, and Jay Gale. Now, they were the upperclassmen when we were there.
They were the ones we aspired to be, especially Zygo, who's, you know, mm-hmm. like been a Broadway actor for years.
Yes. So of the lot of us, he's certainly had the most success.
Mm-hmm. But they were all super cool dudes.
They were very laid back, very chill, amazing talent and great senses of humor. They also had all the parties for the underclassmen because they were off campus. So one day, I want to say the weather was nice, so it may have been in the spring or it may have been in the fall because you and I were still just sort of
hanging out. Well, when did they rush? Did they do it both semesters?
I don't know who of them rushed. It might have just been Matt, who was the frat guy.
No, I mean, when did the sororities and fraternities rush?
That's right. They do it in the fall and they do it in the spring.
Okay, so it could have been.
Yeah,
right, anyway,
most likely it was the fall. A lot of parties. We go there, and there is a pile of cans
that you can stand. This is the story you're telling. Yes. Okay, I was thinking the flock of gold. Okay.
Oh, no. That one is good as well. But we were on the subject of your car.
Yes, yep.
How sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't.
Whenever I had a girlfriend, my car would stop working. My car got jealous. It was very, it was impossible to ignore the correlation. Anyway, go on.
Yes. So we are drafted. It's the opposite of a fetch quest. It is, we have all these cans. Our parents are coming. We need to get them out of this house. You guys get the cans out. Keep whatever the deposit is, and we're ready.
Also, their landlord came by, saw the pile, and said, "You can't have this." And then she saw an empty keg, and she goes, "You're not supposed to have that, are you?"
Yep.
So,
yes, it was evacuation mode.
Mm-hmm.
So we load up Mike's car, and it takes some time, but we're chugging along. We drive to the student parking lot,
mm-hmm.
and then the car dies.
As it was wont to do. Yes. It was a 89 Plymouth Sundance.
It had a name, too. I'm trying to...
The Live Mobile.
Yes.
Because I only play live, the band live in it.
Yep. That's, so.
It's just so sad.
I'm not proud
no
of
wonder
my,
it didn't work.
I'm not grief. Proud of my music taste, but you know what? It was my thing. Anyway, go
ahead. Yeah. No, first concert I saw. Yeah. So anyway, we now have this car filled on a campus parking lot with beer cans.
And I'm like desperately trying to cover it with like old crappy
blankets. Oh yeah,
blankets.
The old Afghan blankets, the kind that you like see on the side of the road, sell them $3 for $5 or something. So it stayed there for about 24 hours before you were able to get the car working again.
Yeah, because I always would, I'd either take it to the mechanic, I'd get someone to tow me, or I'd like fiddle with it. Because the car was so primitive back then, you could fiddle with it and kind of get it to work.
Yes. I remember it was just wires at one point or another.
Yeah, well, that was after graduation. I still had it, yeah. And I, like, hardwired the fan.
It was amazing.
But so as long as I didn't forget to take off the positive lead from the fan, because it went drain the battery,
yep.
It would work. But otherwise, it would overheat. So yeah. It was just sort of damned if you damned it.
The only thing I've seen anything like it was my next-door neighbor's car that he would start with a screwdriver. It was just
yeah.
A tribute to jerry-rigging. And I want to say we made a decent penny off.
I think it was $50 or $60.
Yeah, it was enough for us to fund sort of the underclassmen party. And that was when the torch was passed.
Mm-hmm. And then we eventually went on and we had a house. It was a different house, but we had a house that became the theater house.
Which I drove by in Geneseo on the way over. I didn't stop by because I know that my wife Molly and the kids and I are going to want to just sort of take a look at it.
Sure.
But I did see that they've got a new road sign.
Yes. And I think the sidewalks were redone or something about the front had been redone. But I think the porch was still sloping.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Our mailman stopped delivering mail to us because in the winter, we didn't salt. We were college guys. But the stairs all sloped and the porch sloped. So it was like, when it got icy, it was like a death trap for a poor mailman to get up to the mailbox to put the mail in. So he just stopped delivering mail. He's like, fix it or I'm not delivering your mail
anymore. Yeah, sure.
So our landlord's like, all right, Joe. He's like, all right, I guess I'll fix it for you.
I was real broken up not to get my bills and my Maxim subscription.
The Maxim got passed around. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the story I thought you were going to tell really quick was the flock of birds story.
Yeah. Now, bear in mind, this stars one of these guys, Matt Britt, again.
Yes. You remember, you've seen Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, right?
Yeah.
You remember the pigeon, with the seagulls on the beach, like Sean Connery with the umbrella?
He scares them with the umbrella.
They crash a Nazi plane or whatever. So similar to that, so there was a sorority, I guess I won't name it just in case. One of the, probably the, they were called the Barbie sorority.
Okay.
What that's worth.
In a kind of a derogatory sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like they were very much the cookie cutters.
Yeah, there was a certain archetype of young lass that would rush this, which was probably the most exclusive of the sororities. But one thing that they made them do, actually, maybe it wasn't them. I could be wrong. Regardless, I'm not naming them, so I'm okay. One of the trust pledge exercises they would make them do was they would make them like hold hands or put their hands on their shoulders.
I think it was hold hands.
Blindfolded and lead them around town.
Mm-hmm.
So they're big, the big sister, who is their pledge master or whatever, would lead them, and they'd have to trust blindly when they cross the street.
Okay.
So the same Joker.
This is stuff I did in theater class, so this is kind of...
Oh, maybe you rushed that sorority.
We didn't have them. We didn't have those.
Sure you did.
Now, where did you go to school?
I went to Grinnell College in the middle of Iowa.
Oh, okay.
It's a small, small liberal arts school.
Gotcha.
We were also a small liberal arts school.
Yeah. I mean, that was the beauty of it. There were four streets.
Yeah.
And four bars when we went there.
Yeah,
that sounds
three
now,
pretty
right?
Similar.
I saw
the IB's gone.
Yeah, the IB's gone. I saw the Idle Hour.
Vital
has turned into a burrito place.
What?
Really disappointed. This was the most pub-like of them.
Yeah, we have someone we went to the most.
Yeah, so the Dagger in the Heart there. You had the Idle
Statesman.
Statesman
Idol,
is
Idol,
gone.
Vital, IB, and Statesman. Statesman's gone too?
Yeah.
We got one bar left?
It's Kelly's.
Kelly's. Yeah,
it's
which Idol's, burned down.
Kelly's. And this new place called Intermission, which I didn't see.
So like the in-between, the IB is now the Intermission?
Apparently that's where the sorority housing is.
So the the Kelly's was weird. Kelly's was the salt miner bar. So they were, okay. I don't know if they never closed or they just opened like at 3 a.m. Yeah. So you would be walking to class like 8 a.m, you'd walk by and there'd be these grizzled, salt encrusted, bearded guys like drinking a beer, just kind of looking forlornly out the plate glass window. It's very weird.
So was there some conflict between town and gown there?
There very likely might have been. Probably. We never saw it because it was different shifts.
Yeah.
Kelly's was also 5 minutes slower than everyone else. So when 2 a.m. rolled around and the bar started closing, you knew that you could get your last call at Kelly's.
And a Long Island iced tea. Or no, a Jack and Coke was Jack, glug, 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 Coke, splash. That was a Jack and Coke there. Yep. Okay, I'm going to tell the story and then we're going to get to why it actually, like, we waited for this time for you to come visit.
Indeed.
there was a group of these sorority pledgees crossing the street. So they were, like, across the entire street, blindfolded.
Uh-huh.
And so Matt had... pulled, like, you know, you would stop because you're not a psychopath. But he pulled up to them, put the car in neutral, and then slammed on the gas and just honked his horn. Did he yell like you're all going to die? He might have yelled something,
I don't know if he yelled, but the metaphor that you had, which was the Last Crusade seagulls.
They just scattered like birds. Cause they're like, I mean, fight or flight, literally response at that point.
Sure you can imagine the notes that were hit on the register as the girls began to shriek and scream.
So, I'm sorry. I was so eager to dive in with our old stories. So, Dan, talk about yourself here. Introduce yourself.
All right. The details of my life are quite inconsequential.
Oh, God, Dr. Evil. Yes.
Nice, nothing like a 20-year-old reference to stay nice and topical.
Remember, I get yelled at for doing it too much.
Oh, it was everywhere. I was actually thinking, because this is the 20-year reunion for us.
Oh, that's right.
And so it was saying, okay, what's the 20-year movie going to be like? I think you couldn't go wrong pulling Austin Powers because everybody quoted it.
Yep.
So in that vein, talking about lots of pop culture references, Mike and I had been talking about the...
Wait, no, introduce yourself.
Oh, the movie, yes. Oh, yeah, me.
You. Yeah, the whole thing. We'll get to the movie. Yes.
So, yeah, my name's Dan Saper. Grew up in a town called Nyack, which is 12 miles north of New York City. It's actually technically off Broadway. We'd get big stars like Jackie Gleason come through. Mm-hmm. And
so that would be close to Westchester?
Yes, it's right across the river from Westchester. Okay. So, you know, the Revolutionary War was fought on the Westchester side. The Indians all lived on my side. Mm. And we had the Underground Railroad, too, which gives us more street cred. So from there, I went to Geneseo, met Mike and a number of other folks. Originally, it was on a nature hike. It was that freshman orientation. Yeah. It was like, okay, whoever went on that nature hike became good friends for a good long while. I actually was reading some, I think it was Penn State, doesn't want to do hikes anymore because they're worried about people getting hurt. So it's like one of those things where question the judgment of any Penn State official that you see is one.
I thought you were going to say getting it on. No, it's getting high.
Is hurt a euphemism for something?
Yeah, I was going to say, oh yeah, you don't want to endanger the youth. Hey, remember that one time?
God, and I then went out to the woods. Time? I got so hurt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hungry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Papa Joe. So, anyway, I've been in Buffalo now since right after graduation.
Yeah, you went right to Buffalo. Actually, I was going to ask that. Have you had the same job for like...
I'm coming up on 15 years. The year after I left was, as Wayne would put it in Wayne's World, an extensive collection of name tags and hairnets. Because I would work... first, I was at an environmental group that was supposed to go around and just sort of raise awareness.
Sounds very you.
Yep.
Okay.
And, you know, if I could have made a living on it, great. But it was 100% commission.
Can you put your drink down?
And I got chased by dogs. So, enough of that. And then...
Did the dogs also get commission for how many environmental stations?
It's a good point. They probably
if they're well-trained. Yeah. But for those of you who are from Buffalo, just a bit of concept of what I had to do. Because it went from 2 to 10, and I didn't know the bus schedule from a hole in my head, I had to walk from, like, downtown Buffalo, not too far from the Fruit Belt, all the way up to Sheridan Drive. It took me maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours to get home, and I had no idea where I was going. So I was walking on the major artery roads, the ones that the cars are coming down. There's no safe sidewalks.
Wow. Now, and by the way, I mean, that's terrifying because your mom used to always joke with your kind of famously bad sense of direction that you were of the 13th lost Jewish tribe.
That's right.
That was your mom's go-to joke whenever you would get lost or be late. Yep.
The scouts had the same thing when I was in charge of trying to do compass and orienteering. You know, why were the Jews lost in the desert for 40 years? Dan Saper had the map. But after doing a little bit of that and then a little bit of improv as well until my first child was born, I fell into a job backwards for one of the local banks and have been there for about 15 years now.
Damn. Wow. Yeah. That's a long time these days.
For your age and this time. Yeah. That's really impressive.
Well, I've noticed I've definitely of the old school, which was, okay, you work at the one job, you work there for 25 years, and you get a pension.
And a gold watch.
And a gold watch. Oh, my first year there, they say, okay, you've been here for a year. What's your anniversary gift? I said, I want the watch. Why? So I can say that the company gave me a watch.
Yeah. Do you want me to keep it completely clean? Are your kids going to listen?
Tell you what, we're going to do the Marvel Universe level of censorship. In that they know certain words because we need that all desperate PG-13 rating, but we'll avoid the big seven.
Okay.
Which we'll have to come back to later because finding just that right age group nowadays for all these great geek culture movies coming out.
We're struggling with that too.
Been a balancing act. So
you've been doing improv in Buffalo for a while.
I've been out of the game longer than I've been in it.
Okay.
My daughter is 9 now. I stopped when she was just before she was born because I knew I was going to be needed around the house. So the bank that I worked at, like many banks, has extended hours. And normally, if you're going to work till 6 o'clock on Friday, I don't know about anyone else. If I were a director, I wouldn't want to cast somebody who I knew wasn't going to be available on Fridays and weekends were going to be tight.
Yeah.
Now, you will appreciate this because I got a lot of flack for my accent when I was in college.
He's pointing at me.
Yep.
Because, yes, where is Dan Saper from was a very common question, especially if someone met him for the first time.
Absolutely. It was a hit. I go, and they want to do at this theater. It's the first time I want to get back into acting. Mm-hmm. And they're doing the importance of being earnest. Okay, great. Got a bit of an accent. I can do the British humor. Oscar Wilde all the way. But I get there, and I read the cast board, and there, anyone who's seen Alice's Restaurant or listened to the Arlo Guthrie song, there in capital letters on the other side of the page, away from everything else on the other side, I hate accents. So I get up on stage, and I'm ready to do my thing. It's like, are you that British kid who left a message on my phone? I'm like, no, man, this is just the way I talk. Needless to say, I did not get the part.
It's like Tommy Wiseau.
Yep, but it was totally worth it because as I leave, this attractive young lady comes up.
Somebody thought this was a British accent.
Someone thought this was British.
Listen, I mean, come on. Yeah.
As long as I've known bonkers. Dan, people have been getting it wrong. Yep. It's really hard to play. In fact,
it just seems precise. It doesn't seem like an
accent.
Which
is exactly
what it
is.
Seem like. Maybe like a little bit of an affectation, but not an accent.
Right. And that's, you've hit the nail on the head there. And real quick. So the lady who comes up after me opens up her mouth and this thick Quebecois accent rolls out. I'm like, okay, there you go, director. There's your instant karma. But my accent, for those of you who have a background in acting or TV and film or radio and are listening to this podcast, is not really an accent so much as it's an inherited loss of one. My father grew up in Brooklyn and had the real Brooklyn kind of accent, which meant that no one would really take him seriously in any.
Hey, well, I'm educated and I'm a very deep thinking guy. Why are you laughing? Hey, come back here. I'm going to kick you.
Now, what we're going to do about that tumor there is we're just going to go in, root around, and I'm ripping off the Jack Foxworthy bit and see if we can't find that fungal clot. You know what I mean? So he got rid of that and became, because he wanted to work for the radio, a non-regional dialect.
Mm. So not the Atlantic Eastern Seaboard dialect.
Right, not that like...
Audrey
Hepburn or Catherine Hepburn sort of thing. Mm-hmm. No, it was more like your TV news anchor who would sound the same. And then my mom grew up in different New York ethnic neighborhoods, Queens. She was where I remember from. She would lived in a few other places as well. So what I have is a combination of her method of speech and my dad's complete lack of accent.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you put the two together, you get this very precise, but not really localized.
Yeah, I wouldn't place it anywhere, but I wouldn't.
Motor speaking.
I certainly wouldn't consider it to be an accent. It's
Well, I'm also used to, especially nowadays, controlling the projection of my voice because I do work in a bank in a cubicle office where the acoustics carry. Mm-hmm. So I went from, okay, I can do the stage projection, but I don't want to discuss everybody's business. So usually, especially around the time that the social security number makes its way into the conversation, I lean in.
Did you say?
Oh, there have been some occasions. So yeah, the other issue now is the stern father figure controlling just the right level of tone to get the desired response.
Did you find like you kind of found it naturally? I like thought it was going to be hard because I don't think my voice is very commanding, but I can just fall into the stern dad voice like instantly.
And I think I've heard you do it and it's good. My dad, I would call him Batman from the old Batman the Animated Series.
No, not the I'm Batman, Batman.
No, not Christopher Nolan. The real Batman. The Kevin Conroy Batman.
Yeah. Oh, the cartoon.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Which, if anyone's ever watched, you have that Bruce Wayne sort of, I'm going to talk to you, and hey, Harvey, what's going on? That was my dad on the phone, especially when he was talking about Cub Scout-related things. But when that phone went down.
Oh, he had a phone voice.
And when he was done, it was never, we didn't get yelled at all that often. It was that real quiet, calm mode of speaking where you knew you were in danger for your life if you did not pick that up right now. And that's sort of where I'm at. Unfortunately, yesterday popped up as well. It's the stereotype of the dad sitcom where no one listens to dad.
What? I'm sorry, did you say something?
Exactly. Like, hey, we're at a lacrosse game. It's late. They're losing. Fourth quarter. We should probably go. No. We all got our funny hats and our orange-colored wigs, and it was a great time, don't get me wrong. But we didn't get home with the kids until about 11:30.
Oh, jeez.
Yep. And so one's 9, the other's 5. Went exactly as you might imagine.
Yeah, that's not good.
But anyway, getting back to the Buffalo Improv thing.
Yes.
Just a second.
Cat Venom was the name of the troupe.
I'm sorry?
Cat Venom was the name of the troupe.
That sounds kind of familiar. When Mike was off in
New York the second York, time, yeah. The second time when you did all the cool stuff.
Yeah, we were going around doing all the cool stuff, doing festivals and stuff while Mike was away
in New York, meeting people after they met them.
Yeah, so we one of the years I can't remember how many years ago this was, but we went to a Toronto festival and we met our counterparts from Buffalo, which was kind of a weird trip.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The high point of it was our group had this big tall guy named Ken Clam.
Okay.
And
did they have a big tall guy?
They had a big tall guy
named Clam Ken?
Named Rich Lamb.
That's awesome.
And it was Rich Lamb and Ken Clam, and they were similar.
Yeah, an accounting firm or a law firm.
Yeah. Clam and Lamb. Yep. Or a restaurant, you know.
Do you remember the name of your Buffalo counterpart?
I don't. Nah, it was such a long time ago.
Yeah.
That's why he thinks maybe, maybe they were there.
Yep. I know comedy sports has been rather prominent, but I've been out of the scene, so there may be some other things beyond that I'm not even aware of. I'll tell you who has made a really good splash in the theater scene, from what I can tell, in Buffalo.
LaBanca?
LaBanca is now in St. Louis.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he's heading his own theater group, which is fantastic, with focus on social justice.
Wow, that's awesome.
Elliot Fox.
Oh, yeah, I have seen him around more.
A lot of Theater of Youth, a lot of Shakespeare in Delaware Park. I'll throw this out because he's always posting it on Facebook. I think he's a karaoke DJ at Hot Mama's Canteen.
Wow. Giving other people plugs.
So I'm very generous with my plugs that now Mike's going to have to scrub all of them later on.
No, it's fine.
Social justice theater? Is this picking up kind of an Augusto Boal sort of thing? Or?
No, not so much as that. As he had a purpose, and it wasn't just, okay, we're going to put on an entertaining show. It would usually be something in relates to discrimination against women or speaking for that feminist sort of voice that might be otherwise underrepresented. And from what I understand, not only would there always be a show, there'd usually be a panel discussion afterwards. So it's one of these great things that allows theater to do more than just entertain, but to educate and drive the discussion. Karat Kadwani does quite a bit of that as well in a one-woman show.
Yep.
So that does kind of bring me... I don't know if you've heard of Augusto Boal. He's this... I think he's from Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
He is doing... he has a book called Theater of the Oppressed.
Okay.
In which he uses theater techniques to kind of get people to become more socially aware of things.
That's cool.
It's a little bit out there, but mm-hmm. one of the cool things was he and his theater group were at one point elected to be mayor of a village.
That is fantastic.
And they use like improv principles to make decisions and to solve problems while they were.
And they actually ran the village.
Yeah.
They went for it. That's awesome.
That's fantastic. One of my parenting techniques that I go for all the time is a tip that Mike and I were taught when we were at that Second City workshop, which was always play at the top of your game.
Mm-hmm.
So don't just settle for coasting. If you mm-hmm. Don't worry about who's not going to get the reference. Those that do are really going to appreciate it.
You have to reward your audience. I hate to do this.
Yes.
We did kind of set all this up around a specific event.
Oh, yeah. No,
I want to get to that.
Yes.
I do have one other question for you, though.
Please.
Do you forgive me yet for ruining the end of The Sixth Sense?
Let the record show.
His arm's on my shoulder, but I don't know if it's going to go around my throat yet.
Not only do I forgive you, do you forgive me?
Oh, this should be good.
For having read in Entertainment Weekly prior to coming to Geneseo. The spoiler alert, he's dead.
You son of a... You've been making me feel bad for... What is... Ah, oh, God!
20 years of guilt over the... Was it the cardinal rule of geek culture? No spoiler before its time.
It had been a... I thought the statute limited... I was a notorious spoiler. Yep. I don't have a good excuse.
Well, in fairness also...
I'm sure you deserved it.
I did.
This was back before every magazine that you ever read has that... Click here to avoid the spoiler.
Yeah.
It was just in parentheses, the Entertainment Weekly writer, thanks guy, said, by the way, he's dead. I'm like, okay. But I will also say this. Many people hate the spoilers because it ruins what's coming for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always of the different vein is that I'm avoiding spoilers like the plague, especially when things like Infinity War came out or The Last Jedi. I won't watch the trailers.
Mm-hmm.
But when a spoiler does make its way through, I do find that it helps me appreciate the build up to that spoiler. For example, if you watch The Sixth Sense and you already know what's happening,
mm-hmm. you can appreciate it a very different way.
It's an entirely different movie.
Yep. I recently rewatched Altered Carbon because I knew where everything was going to happen. And
okay.
I was picking up on a lot of stuff because, you know, you kind of have to.
Yeah, that one I haven't watched yet.
It's good. It's definitely not a watch around the kids. But
well, that's why we had to take it off our queue.
Yeah.
The cover at one point was the man wrapped up in plastic.
Yep.
Put that right next to the kids' show so you get some questions.
What's that next to Dora the Explorer, Dad?
Yeah, he's fine.
So
will that lead us into the...
I think so, yeah. So spoilers and Netflix and talking about... So
you have been warned.
I had asked you a while back, hey, you know, I'd really like to get you on the podcast. Yeah. Would you be able to? And you said, well, I'd like to... Wouldn't it be cool to do one about Ready Player One?
Yes.
And so you said, let's wait until the movie comes out, which it's now out. And we've all seen it. And then, so you made the trip out to Buffalo. Now... to go back to the drink for a second.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I did, as I always do, I offered Dan, like, hey, do you want to bartend? Do you want to drink? Do you want to not want to drink? And he said, oh, well, you know, I'd love to have a drink. You know, I'll leave the bartending to you. But he said, you know, just as a thought, because I didn't know what to make. He said, well, you know, Ready Player One's all about collecting loot, which Mike in particular can appreciate because he's a horribly addicted loot hound. He still replays Diablo 3 and stuff in Borderlands.
Oh, that's fantastic.
and you said, what better way to carry your loot than with a mule?
Ah.
And then I said, okay, well, there's a lot of different types of mules. And I said, well, given that Ready Player One takes place in a dystopian future where nutrients are scarce, scurvy's a threat. So this is a citrus mule. Also, as I like to call it, a scurvy-bustin' citrus mule.
All right. Well, you're missing... I hate... Actually, I love to throw this at you.
Yep.
Because you're missing a tremendously obvious and famous reference to the 80s right here, which was the original computer game Mule.
Yeah, I'm not going to remember that.
Well,
Here is...
That's what Dan meant, right?
Oh, clearly. Of course is what I meant. But that in a crux is the rise and fall of Ready Player One.
Okay. Well, let me plug Mule here.
Please.
It was a game that was originally, I think, created on the Atari... 800 computers.
800.
Going back.
Which was mentioned in the book.
Yeah, actually, I do kind of remember Mule.
And was ported to Commodore 64. I think it was actually more popular on the Commodore because it was...
Because it was the Commodore and more people had it?
Yeah, yeah. And it was a resource game. It was a wonderful little game where you were the four players were placed on a colonized planet, and they had to pick your little parcel of land, and it was just the parcel like would go across this grid, and it was the first person who pushed the button would get that grid.
Computer auction.
Yeah, and ties would go to the person with the lowest score.
Okay.
So it was really a super amazing balance game.
And up to four players could play it?
Yeah.
That's something
to say. Locally or on a Usenet? Or?
No, it's locally.
Okay.
What?
I don't know.
What the heck are you talking about? This is the 80s, sir.
You're right. I'm sorry. I'm showing my age right now.
And then you would proceed to your choices were to set up a solar collector to get energy, to farm, to get food, to mine something called Smith ore, or to mine another resource, not really a resource, but it was called Christite, which was like just money. So the Smith ore was used to produce the components that people would need.
Okay.
Like the mules. So you would go to the store, get a mule, which was a robotic mule thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then you would take it into the appropriate fitting station. Okay, I'm going to fit it for farming. I'm going to fit it for solar power or whatever. And then you take it out. You would take it out along the map and get to your parcel and then land it there, and it would become whatever you wanted it to, it was supposed to be.
It's amazing how so much of this is like, it just sounds like you're describing a Warcraft.
I know, but it was it was simple and beautiful. It's in simplicity.
It makes perfect sense.
And then the players would later, you know, after you produced all your resources, you need energy to run everything. Mm-hmm. You would need food to be able to move around and do what you need to do.
Okay.
And then the if you ran out of Smith Thor, the store would run out of mules.
Oh, dear.
So it was a neat competition, but you're also working together to make the colony as good as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful game. It's a classic. It's very highly regarded today, and I loved it.
That's awesome.
And it was mentioned in Ready Player One.
I don't know if the game was. It should have been.
It seems like it would have that.
Might be. But they mentioned the computers and everything.
Right,
so.
Right.
Yeah,
so this is what mule means to me with regard to
the 80s.
Yes.
So we have just blown it out of the water in terms of getting the theme and the drink married. So I'm very happy there.
Indeed.
So let us open up this conversation, because I know that Dan and I have different opinions about the movie. And now that's Mike's
And read, I probably do too.
Yeah. Now that you've read more of the book, then we're all going to have different opinions, which is awesome. So Dan, you've read the book.
Yes, I've read the book. I was late to the book game, in that I only read it for maybe around January. I'd gotten it as a holiday present.
Okay.
Read the book, loved the book.
It's not deep. It's like popcorn. You kind of go through it.
It's popcorn with enough meat there that if you scratch the subtext, you could divulge a bit more, especially from a sociology standpoint.
Mm.
A good one like that. It's not as layered as perhaps The Hunger Games might be.
Sure.
But there's enough going on behind the scenes.
Certainly. So just to interrupt, I think we are going to clearly spoil the movie if anybody's concerned about that.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Ready Player One yet, go see it. It's a fun Spielberg movie, I guess. and then come back to this part of this podcast.
And we might not spoil the entire book, because I've only read the first half of it or so.
But okay. I'm telling you, there's a point where you're at where once you get past that point, the movie and book realign.
Yeah.
So people have been warned at this point.
Yes, that's fair.
So, book. Loved book. Anyone who hasn't seen the book, it was described in the back cover as Willy Wonka meets the Matrix, and I feel that's very apt.
Yeah.
The movie takes on certain characteristics, and the whole idea is that there's a lot of Easter eggs, a lot of spoilers and pop culture references, all through the perspective of this one Willy Wonka-esque character with Asperger's, Halliday, who creates the Oasis. And so, what I find as a challenge, both in the movie and as I try and decide, are my kids old enough to enjoy this, is what the right age level is. The book, written, I'm sure, for adults. It was not a young adult sort of thing. It wasn't a teeny bopper kind of novel.
The subject matter would... Why would a 13-year-old read it?
Now why would they care about the 80s?
Right.
That's the challenge.
That's really interesting, because that was one of my takeaways so far from reading the book, too. I'm like, who is this written for?
Yep.
I don't know, because I'm reading it, and I lived this.
Yes.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s, I'm very familiar with most of these references.
But are you connecting to the young protagonist's, like, hero's journey
not
thing?
Not really. Right. It's a weird relationship for between me, for me, to the material and the protagonist. And one thing that I find very irritating about the book is the constant need to explain things that I know. I'm like, why? I'm skipping paragraphs. It's like, I know this. I know what this reference is. I know what this was.
So this is apologetic and apologetic. So, okay. So we don't, I think it's written for Dan and mine's age group. It's about 10 years.
Maybe.
I think it's that specific cohort, the Oregon Trail generation.
Yeah. Well, the Xennials.
Yes.
And Klein is our age, from what I understand. The author is our age.
Yes, and it's worth noting that Klein not only wrote the novel, but he was the screenwriter for the novel, for the movie, along with Zach Penn. So it was interesting in that when the movie and the book takes divergent paths, it's not that they, to my knowledge, are bastardizing the author's internal vision. No, the author was heavily involved in the making of this film and how it was adapted to the screen.
Still felt bastardized to me.
It's almost two different stories.
Yeah. But I the same thing with Stranger Things. Did you watch Stranger Things?
Oh, love Stranger Things.
So it's kind of similar in that Dan and I were born in the very beginning of the 80s. So I remember a lot of that stuff. I get that nostalgia, but I don't remember it and I don't recall it like you do. So the explanations don't seem apologetic or insulting to me. I'm like, I needed a refresher.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So I feel like the late 30s is probably the ideal age for that story, especially the book, because I don't know, do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I mean, a good case in point, the first half of the book, so I don't think I'll be giving anything away for Smike. I'm a big Dungeons & Dragons aficionado. That's my passion, the way that other folks have movies and video games. They used the Tomb of Horrors and this antagonist, a lich named Asarak, pretty extensively.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, love my D&D. Never played at the time when...
Well, that was Asarak, first edition, right?
That was first edition.
Yeah. We were second edition.
Exactly. Yeah. That was our generation was the second.
One, I'll just throw this out because Jim... oh my gosh, what's his name?
Morrison.
No, the guy who made The Oasis.
Halliday.
Jim Halliday. Halliday. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's Daniel Halliday.
I thought it was Jim. James? Was
James Halliday. Yes, we're both wrong.
His experience with Dungeons & Dragons as described in the book is so similar to mine.
Was there a girl in your group? That?
No, I was. I never got to that point, though, being in the group.
Yep.
But I was like, I had all of these books, and I had modules, and I was like, I would love to play this someday.
Exactly.
But I didn't, you know, I didn't have, the friends who were really into that.
Gaming group.
Yeah. So yeah, it was like I know exactly what that was like.
The problem, Mike, is you are Halliday. So that's...
Well, it's interesting in that there is that whole generational stigma. Our generation, Mike, myself, and Mike, had to be prepared for some locker stuffing if you were going to get really geeked out about whatever your chosen passion was.
Being geeky was a dirty thing.
Oh yeah,
it was something to be ashamed of. Yep.
I didn't tell my wife that I played D&D until we were married for at least 5 years.
Maybe that's something I got to tell you.
That's exactly how it went down.
I know. I actually remember you
saying that. And she's like, Dan, I know. I've always known.
Yeah. I love you despite that.
Yes. That's not wrong. So,
And Halliday was actually a few years younger than me. Mm-hmm. So it would have been a little bit more acceptable for him to, or easier for him to get into a group than it was.
Yeah, I get it. You out-geek us.
Well, today's generation, if there's anything that you like, I guarantee you there's a Facebook group or a message board about it.
Yeah.
There's no sense of that isolation that so many of these other people would kind of go through.
Can I dive into that really quick, actually?
Yeah, please.
So I read a really interesting article, I think it was in The Atlantic, about how this movie had to overcome Gamergate. And I'm not sure to what extent it was over-intellectualizing it, as The Atlantic is wont to do.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And by Gamergate, you're referring to how the one female gamer was really harassed. Is that correct?
It was a reviewer. And we've talked about Gamergate in the past here. But if you're not familiar with Gamergate, look it up, because it's a black eye in the history of game culture, for sure. But
a black eye, really, like an emergence of something to the...
That's true. Bringing to the surface something that's already there. That's, thank you. That's fair. Because, and that was when I didn't even know what Gamergate was. Smike, 10 years, 11 years, my senior, had explained it to me. And then I was like, oh, you know what? I'm not sure I care about gaming culture too much anymore. But that feeling of like, well, the kids, I've had that too. Like, the kids nowadays have it so easy. Like, I feel like it all kind of is part and parcel with that. But it's like, sometimes we do the life raft thing where it's like, well, in our day it was harder. You know, we're more geeky because we had to, you know, be that picked on. But it's kind of awesome that kids nowadays can love something that's quote unquote geeky and not have to deal with alienation or isolation. But a lot of people our age are like, well, in my day.
Well, if that was sort of how you became good friends. I mean, one of the first things that you and I bonded over was a love of the character Driss Doerden.
Yeah.
Who I think now is...
Talked about that last podcast. I was the author. I had a pen pal with.
Oh, fantastic. R.A. Salvatore?
Yeah, R.A. Salvatore.
That's sweet. I just saw something, a big magazine this month on Dragon Plus, getting real geeky here for you fans. 30th anniversary of when The Crystal Shard first came out.
You know, he's so, writing more books.
He never stopped. I don't think he ever will.
Oh, okay.
And I feel bad for him because...
He's been pigeonholed into that.
Not only has he been pigeonholed into it, but as the needs for the game and the industry change, he's had to do so many, not so much recons, but revamps of the characters. The protagonists that you've known had to die off because they're humans. They couldn't live for centuries the way his other characters were. Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman of Dragonlance went through this a lot, where they completely... revamped the setting to adapt to the new rules and wrote themselves into some interesting convolutions as a result.
Well, when you're writing, you know, fiction based on a game, a product, you know, like you're going to run, especially such a long running product.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I thought it was interesting. You brought that up. I've said that. I think about it now. I'm like, I don't feel like I was on the bad side of... If I had been involved, I would not have been on the bad side of Gamergate because I think inclusion, it should be all about inclusion.
Yeah.
But then I catch myself doing that, well, when I was a geek, you know, it's not about gender at that point. It's just about being picked on and feeling isolated.
Yeah.
It's funny how it just stays with you.
Yeah, you got to show off your war wounds every once in a while.
Right, right. But I think I was there. I got into an argument with this young kid at a GameStop once. It was not my proudest moment. I was trying to out-geek him. This kid totally had me beat. Him and he was 15 years younger than me. He and his brother were reconditioning arcade cabinets. And I realized it halfway through and I'm like, I'm just going all in, but I'm gonna lose. And Eric is like, can we go please? This is idiotic. Yeah. So I'm not above it. But anyway, okay. So that's the book.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. So in the book, the first half, just to sort of bring us back to where we were in the conversation, references this specific touchstone. And for that touchstone, someone who lived it said, okay, no, I've been there, I've done that. For Mike and I, who came around just a little bit later, we need the refresher.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have the young kids that none of this is going to have any real emotional impact any longer. They are very much like the egg hunters, the Gunters in this, where they're just trying to learn the clues to solve the mystery. And in the book, it's a good mystery, so... credit where credit's due. There was a nice narrative to be had.
I think that the younger the reader, the more they become one of the Gunters. And I thought that was actually one of the more brilliant things about the book is the younger you are, the more removed you are from Halliday's interests, the more you become one of these characters for that exact reason.
Right.
And I do think I think it's just the nature of the book.
And it's a sort of insight into this one character, Halliday, where in order to really understand, you have to get into this guy's psychology. And they do a decent job, I think, of that in the movie, because they only have 2 hours to tell it.
Yeah.
Where by the end, you understand that they're looking at it from a specific point of view to solve a specific clue. Whereas in the book, it's more free-sprawling, where it's at 5 years, we don't know what's important yet. We're just going to compile all of it in a way you only can in today's technology.
Mm-hmm.
And just pour through it.
One thing that struck me after reading the book, then watching the movie, then just rereading the book a couple of weeks ago on a trip, Halliday is a D-bag. What kind of megalomaniac buries that much money in such errant minutiae that people have to devote their lives to figure it out? It's like, I didn't pick up on that the first time.
Well, that's what got me. I mean, there is a point where in order to advance and solve the mystery, the protagonist, Wade Williams?
Wilson.
Has to reenact one of Halliday's favorite movies.
Yeah.
Not only line by line, but inflection by inflection.
And like, by posture, and yeah, he gets bonus points for it.
Yeah, it's all couched into the terms of, okay, you're a video game and you're going for the high score actor hero, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But what this is saying is that you have Halliday, less being a touchstone of his generation, saying, okay, you must like what I like because I need you to be my custodian of this world that I've created. And so I have to get a very specific, very selective person, as opposed to just saying, hey, wasn't that movie cool? Wasn't it great? Yeah, I agree too. Let's be friends. No, far more selective.
Yeah, okay. We're getting deeper into the rabbit hole here.
Yes.
Which is fine. I wanted to do. I think that's an excellent point. I think also that the whole idea, the concept of the Oasis and what society's become is horrifying.
Yes.
And that is, it's touched on a little bit in the book.
Way more than in the movie, though.
But, yeah, much more.
It actually, so it's way, I think the focus of it is in the later part of the book.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when we're getting into going to the movie, at the end of the movie, we're surprised, he wins.
He wins.
The main character wins that and scrappy gets the prize. Young pup.
I will say that the twist with the quarter is better in the movie than in the book. The book, it's random and stupid how he gets it. In the movie, I thought it was way better done. Sorry, I had a point to say that.
Okay. But one of the things you see at the end of the movie, towards the end, is the button to just end everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's got to be a huge decision, whether he's going to push it or not. And it was just like kind of dropped.
It's a joke.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of a joke. It's kind of a joke. It really was. Too, if I recall.
And I was expecting more of like
deliberation,
more like thought put into this. Like,
I think they dive into it a bit more in the book. Like, okay, you need to understand this. This will shut everything down.
Mm-hmm.
You have that power and I can only trust you because you are my avatar, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
They also, in the movie, alluded to, you're not, Halliday, they say, you're not an avatar, are you?
Yeah, he's like his consciousness in the Oasis.
They just touch on that. Okay, now here is this artificial intelligence, this sentient life, and oh, movie's over. Too bad, so sad.
It just glosses over it.
Yeah.
And that's not in the book. That's purely the movie invention.
Huh.
So that was but yeah, no, you're right.
Is that part of the meta that, you know, is maybe even intentional, that we're supposed to be a little bit horrified that all of this is going on and maybe thinking maybe he should stop this?
I think,
and having
the
character be like, no, I'm not going to stop this.
Well, that, you know, in the movie, and this is at the very end,
mm-hmm,
they make a case for
the closing down.
So close, Tuesdays and Thursdays.
So it's a little weak.
The whole theme ends up being not so much, you know, what is this world? What is identity? And they do some great things in the book,
mm-hmm,
with identity politics there. It's reality is real. Little on the nose, a little bit of a platitude.
Now, to be fair, that line is actually from the book.
Is it? Okay, I was wondering about that.
But that being said, it's a small part of a larger, you know, dive into the nature of... Your concern, Smike, in my opinion, is that in the book, that is much more prevalent. That horror of what Oasis is.
Yes.
But the book also makes a stronger case for the benefits because school is in the Oasis, and they cut that out of the movie entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, I mean, it just, I was making a bit of a joke next. How much does it have to stink for my kids? How much does it have to stink if they decide, okay, because reality is real and we don't want anyone getting hooked, we're going to shut it down Tuesdays and Thursdays? Okay, great. What if you work Tuesdays and Thursdays?
Yeah, which a lot of people do.
Yeah,
even in the story.
Exactly. So your only escape from a horrible reality, even if you want to do it for like an hour or two, just relax. Nope, can't do it Tuesday and Thursday because I'm going to make out with my girlfriend who is surprisingly attractive.
Oh, I have a little tiny poor wine stain. I'm hideous. Don't look at me. Erica was so mad about that.
Yeah.
She's like, in the book, that was such a big deal. Like, it was a huge... Wah.
All right, I haven't got to that part of the... But I imagine it's... I would hope it's something more significant.
It's definitely lamer in the movie than it is in the book.
And that is actually a criticism that I had of the book that I liked the movie better in that they introduced this female character and her dimensionality much sooner. She comes across as a bit of a cipher in the book, something that was always attainable, but didn't really have much of her own personality.
She's a prize. She's a prize. She never gains dimensionality. I don't think she... Well, okay, the only defining aspect is like an echo of what they do in the movie, which is she asks him at one point, I don't know if you got into this, like, what would you do if you won? And he goes, I'd buy a spaceship. And she's like, well, I'd fix the world.
Right.
It's like idealistic. But that is a very weak... cipher element of her that they actually did something with in the movie.
Yeah, she was woke in a way that none of the other characters were.
Right.
And that was her gimmick.
Speaking to what you're speaking, she's the only one who's kind of aware of the horror of the Oasis, when you think about it.
And in the movie, they allude to this backstory of her parents being sort of sucked in by the more corporate machinations of what this world would look like.
They die in a debtor's prison, right?
Essentially.
In the movie?
Yes.
In the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Or at least her dad does. I can't remember if it was both her parents.
In the movie, a lot of that dark part of the book, the descent into darkness, if you will, gets taken up by Wade in probably the next chapter you're about to read.
Yeah, as I was telling him, I kind of explained it. And so we're there, and that's another thing I kind of just bookmarked in my head to talk about. So, and this kind of goes back to the Gamergate thing, right? Of like, well, let's not make this a boy's fantasy. Let's round out some of these characters. So they took some of the cool stuff that Wade does, infiltrating IOI, mm-hmm. and then... in a less cool way, in my opinion, because he's like Mission Impossible style.
Yeah.
He does it. It's actually really smart. Like, I read it, and I was like, this is even better thought out than I thought. But it, like, she ends up doing it a little more off the cuff, but it's still impressive. And I thought that was a good move in so much as let's give her, she's an important character. She happens to be female. They don't necessarily get rounded out as well as characters in these kind of stories, so let's give her more. So I was glad about that.
Yes, but until you see that she's actually going to be an active escaper of her fate and sort of taking her own destiny by the reins, there's 20 minutes where she's captured and you think, okay, this is just going to be a save the princess.
Yep. And maybe that was intentional.
Well, save the princess is such a trope in video games that you can't not.
No, I mean, maybe it was intentional to lead the audience to think that they hadn't read the book. Well,
perhaps.
Actually, at that point, you're off script anyway.
Yeah, that was where I got really annoyed because, okay, this is the one character who they're trying to give some real depth to. And now they've made her a damsel in distress. And it's good that they reeled it back in, but they didn't get into the horrors of what she had to do as a result of being essentially enslaved by this IOI.
Which Wade, I mean, they get into, it's horrible.
She just had to move something heavy, and then she figures out, oh, I can use this position to help out the group.
And he's in a support call center. Right? And he, like, he's enslaved to her support call center in the book, and it is as awful as it sounds. She's, like, put front and center on... She's the man inside.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, gender choice there. She's the person inside who happens to be pivotal to doing something that, like, Wade had to jump through hoops and reprogram digital, you know, a robot to do... Like, my problem with the movie more than anything is the oversimplification. I get why.
Yeah,
doesn't mean... But you know what?
Yeah,
but you know what? I don't have to like it, because it's a weaker story, in my opinion. There are movies that can do a lot more in 2 hours than this one did. You know? That was one I walked away with.
There was a good, probably the most horror-oriented moment was when, as she's enslaved, everyone who's been using these goggles for entertainment and advancement, all of a sudden she finds she can't take them off. And you see a bit of panic. Might have been the best bit of acting throughout the whole movie.
So, okay, if you don't mind, like,
please.
I feel like I'm a moderator. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. So, one critique I read that I absolutely agree with, and hopefully it didn't color what I walked away with, was that when Klein wrote the book back in 2011, VR was a magical future science, right? Like, it was like, we've seen Virtual Boy, and man, it was lame.
I saw one yesterday, 2 copies. And the Nest robot.
Really? Oh, yeah. Rob, the most useless peripheral in the history of the world.
Was this close to buying it for you to add to your trophy wall?
I would have loved it. Yeah. I mean, I had them back then, but I couldn't wait to get rid of them. you know, 7 years, a lot has changed with VR. And it is a little, it's not old hat necessarily, but like, so there was sort of a twofold problem where the whiz-bang factor of, oh, so much of the story takes place in VR, not as impressive as it was 7 years ago. Right? Because VR, you can get it. I have VR all over the damn house.
I mean, this whole thing seems less unreasonable now than it
less futuristic.
Less futuristic. I mean, it could be years and years and years before we get there, but yeah, I can easily see the world of VR going exactly that direction.
And I think it's actually worked out to the movie and books, the plot's advantage, that VR has become so socially acceptable. The biggest touchstone or the biggest version of that you would find prior to that might have been Star Trek The Next Generation's holodeck.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that. So I'm going to tie together. So the failing in this part is that they reduce the horror level that is in the book. And I'm going to hold up Black Mirror.
Okay.
So they just did the USS McAllister episode, which is more I Have No Mouth Yet I Must Scream. Right? Mm-hmm. There was, do you ever watch Black Mirror?
Haven't. A good friend recommended it heartily.
You have that slightly darker sensibility. I think you would really enjoy it. But there was an episode that really freaked a lot of people out, myself included, which was when Netflix resurrected the show.
Mm-hmm.
Bryce Dallas Howard was in it.
Okay.
And it was a very close future where everyone, your entire life is based on your social media score.
I believe it.
And people are constantly scoring each other. Yes. And by the way, China just rolled this out.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
So that episode freaked a lot of people out because Black Mirror never makes technology look nice. So it was, oh my gosh, I can see this coming in the very near future and it looks awful to exist in this world.
Mm-hmm.
That is where I think Ready Player One, this is why Spielberg was not the right person for it. Ready Player One needed to get more into that to make my point is to make virtual reality stickier in the story.
The USS Callister episode was basically the darker version of Ready Player One.
Yeah, I guess. But they were. I don't know. We spent a whole episode on that.
I don't want to get too deep into that.
But to bring up what you said about the acting, the other problem was that a lot of the movie takes place in this computer generated world, and there was a distinct, it wasn't an uncanny valley. They did a good job getting past that, but there was just a lack of like emotiveness.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you mentioned just a little while ago, the main character, he takes a hero's journey. One of the gripes I had about the Wade character is that you don't really see him grow over the course of the movie.
Yeah.
You see a brief throwaway that, he has a lousy home life. He doesn't really like his aunt or his aunt's boyfriend.
And then they're gone.
And then they're gone. Yeah.
Which they, by the way, like, that nice old lady that he's friends with, she also died in that explosion. Yeah. But that's like, it's just utterly glossed over.
It's honestly, I'm halfway through, it's kind of glossed over in the book, too.
That's fair, but at least he stops and thinks, oh, Mrs. So-and-so.
Yeah, like, a little bit.
Come on, she gets a line.
Yeah. There was a greater community outside of the Oasis that he had to interact with, like it or no. Where that doesn't happen at all in the movie. You see that towards the end, we're all going to band together against this corporate guy until corporate guy pulls out a gun, and then they all just sort of part like the Red Sea. So it was just amazing. There's a moment where things could go very bad for our hero in the movie, and he's got a gun pointed to his face, but he doesn't get shot for reasons. The villain has this change of heart based on what he sees.
That was kind of a weird moment.
Not very plausible.
And in the movie, it's I think from what I've read so far, the IOI is much more menacing, much more sinister, much more just ruthless. And you really get the in the book.
Yeah.
In the book.
Yes.
Yeah. And you really get the idea that like they could do whatever they want. And if something blows up in the stacks, nobody's going
to
care.
Yes. Other characters in the book don't make it to the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And it shows you that they're playing at a very high stakes level. By removing that from the movie, you lose some of the suspense.
And the malevolence.
Yes.
Of IOI. But yeah, there is a major character death in the book that they can entirely move from the movie. And it was missed.
Yeah.
I missed it because they were making it a little more PG-friendly or 13-friendly. Yeah.
And Spielberg, he's great for sentimentality. I mean, granted, yes, this is the guy who directed Jaws, but I got a sense of, okay, what's the big takeaway point from Spielberg making this movie? To hammer home the whole reality is real, let's embrace our friendships. Go outside and play.
Exactly. That's what I walked away with.
Yep.
What I walked away with, it was 2 hours of amusement, and that was it. I mean, I got nothing deeper from it.
No.
I really didn't.
I didn't
have a bad time. It was
well, that's
fun.
The thing is, it's not 2 hours wasted. It's just 2 hours you spent and enjoyed the 2 hours while you were doing it.
Yeah.
I feel like the book has, I'm not going to say it's a deep book. There's a little more to it that stuck with me, and I thought about it, even the second time I read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the movie is 2 hours, but it ultimately is telling a very different story with a different tone than the book is. And there, as a parent, as a dad of a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, this is my crux. I'm sure they'll enjoy the movie when they watch it, but how old is the right age for it? Because they're so young, they're not going to get or really care about any of the 80s references.
Nope.
There's enough language that, I know, I'm glad Captain America in the Marvel movies is on the same page as I am, that we have to sort of take a step back from.
Say, that felt odd, like the Spielberg, like, putting cursing in this.
Exactly.
It's like that, you know what? I wouldn't have done that. The direction that Spielberg seemed to be going and nerfing so much of the impact of it and the malevolence, why leave that in?
Because they want the PG-13 rating.
And especially in another golden spot. Another real, real big difference along those lines was that the there was much more a sense that life in the stacks was literally darker and grimier.
Yes.
Yeah. What does he say?
Everything was like bright and colorful in the movie, mm-hmm. even when they were, you know, in the stacks areas. It was like,
eh. He's like, I had to walk by like drug addicts and pedophiles on my way to school every day. Going to school in the Oasis was a lifesaver. It's like, This is
nothing about that.
So
nothing
much darker. Like that. Yeah.
And, you know, I hadn't seen the X-Men movie, so I didn't recognize the actor. But I was kind of hoping that they would pick someone who was a little less photogenic for this ragtag bunch.
Yeah. Wait, who?
The character who played, or the actor who played Wade.
Was who in the X-Men?
Apparently he was Cyclops in X-Men Apocalypse.
Wow. It was not really? A good movie, so I kind of blocked it out. But
I never saw it. I haven't seen it.
I own it, but...
Yeah, only thing I thought was, okay, well... Good news for this guy with a resume is that he's a guy who now can be typecast as having the top half of his face covered and still emote.
No one will take the crown from Carl Urban in the new Judge Dredd, though.
Haven't seen it.
I saw the
Sylvester Stallone.
No. See, yep. The problem is that everyone did.
Yep.
You need to see this. It's a great movie. It's basically the Raid Redemption. This like great parkour escape the building movie.
Okay.
It's basically that in Judge Dreadland, but Carl Urban with just his mouth does the best acting I've ever seen in my life.
Awesome.
And it's not Stallone over the top. It is like, this is the world. This is the character. And I'm buying this nonsense all because of this dude's mouth.
Very cool.
And he does say, I am the law. And it is not, I am the law.
Yeah.
So yeah, here's my question for you guys. What's the right age for this? Is it age 13? Because there's definitely a part where they do the dance, and I thought that was going to be the most visually spectacular, and ends up just being a disco reference.
It was,
there's some double entendres.
It looked like it was literally a gorillas video. I mean, there's a video out, I forget which one it's called, from one of their newer albums. It's basically the same thing.
Wow, just Zero Gravity dancing with computer animated characters?
With like them stepping on a grid that lights up, and it's... Like, I've seen this already.
Yeah, it's been done. There's so much more they could have done. But, the characters of Artemis mm-hmm. is being very coy, like, did you come prepared? And all of a sudden we see that, yes, his 3D body shot works on all parts of his body, even that below the waist. And the movie ends with this climactic fight where it's like, okay, bad guy, you're in my virtual world now. Look at how well I fight. And it's a massive crotch shot.
Yeah. Also, by the way, who would make a suit? An immersive suit that causes pain to your genitalia.
Yeah. You,
what a terrible idea.
Pick the worst thing you can find. That's somebody's fetish.
Yeah, but this is something, you know, that yep. like you wanted to get, but they said it gave you an edge.
Yeah.
And it's like, getting kicked in the crotch is never going to give you an edge anywhere.
At least and that, I mean, that was, that did kind of stand out as especially stupid.
Just egregiously dumb.
But it was like, it was for kids. Yeah, well, it was a kid-level joke.
So, yeah, and to get back to you, so this is one of those rare times I would say, because, you know, my son's a year younger than Davey.
Yeah. It was what? Werewolves Got Nads. It was the same.
Dude, Monster Squad is offensive as heck. Oh my God, that movie did not age well. They are just calling each other FAGs left and right. And I'm like, whoa, this didn't age well. But to go back to
I remember that part though.
It's a great moment.
Yes.
But I would not show Simon that movie for a long time. I'd fast forward. To go back to what your question,
yeah.
I feel like this is one of those few times that I would make them wait longer to read the book first.
Mm-hmm.
Because the movie visually, it's easy to say, well, the visuals are going to draw, pardon me, a kid in, right? Yep. But they're never going to go back to the book.
See, that's what I always tell folks now who are watching it. Now, granted, they're adults. So, okay, if you liked the movie, you'll love the book.
I find that rarely takes with people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rare. I mean, do you know the percentage of people who actually read a book after high school? It is frighteningly low.
Oh, really?
No, it is. It is like 20% of people continue to read books after they graduate school. Some insane number.
That's crazy.
I'm sure the people who are the tens of listeners that we have.
Yes, are you're listening though. You're not reading the transcript.
No, but I'm sure that they're looking up right now, being like, "What is this?" It is something like 20 to 30% of people actually continue reading books after they graduate high school. But this is a situation where I think it would be more fun for them to read the book a little older and wiser, get some of the darkness, and then the movie is more fun. If you showed them the movie, A, you still have to wait a certain amount of time because of the profanity. B, I don't see why they would ever. Now, to be fair, you're very good about reading with your kids. So it's possible that they would. But I feel like it would be an uphill battle to say, remember that visual movie you just watched? It was all computer animated. There's a book. Yep. You want to read it?
And no, they would say, I don't remember much about it. I remember there was stuff and people fighting and that was about it.
Because nothing's done. So for me, this is the time, and again, I had a really negative experience with the movie. I would push to read the book first. So I would make them wait longer. That's my take.
Yep.
So Mike could disagree.
I don't know. I'm at the movie was fluff. The book is a little bit less fluff.
Are you enjoying the book? We have been afraid to broach this because we don't want to
ruin it. Well, I think I told you. Yeah.
It's fun.
It's fun. It's still fluffy, and I'm still super annoyed at every
right.
thing that the every reference has to be explained.
I will use this as a blue point. It's like, okay, if these are the cultural touchstones and I've missed out, I did get back into Rush as a result of the book.
Which, by the way, Rush is nowhere near.
I know. I was mad.
Sorry?
Hey, no.
I don't know.
No, on a mechanical level especially, Rush is pretty incredible.
Rush is... Oh my god.
But Rush is a small part of the book. Everyone was saying, oh, well, they didn't get the rights to Rush.
Rush was mentioned once so far.
Yeah. It is one small part of a gate, I think. It's not even... Because again, in the book, I mean, if you're listening to this, you already know this, but I thought it was very... I liked the books, like... You had to do a quest, find thing to get the key. Then you had to do another different kind of quest to do the gate.
Yes.
And they sort of took the Shining sequence in the movie and combined all of it. You had to reenact the movie to some degree, and then you had to figure out a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, but the book was so much more fun because it was more inventive.
Now, were either of you guys big The Shining fans going in? Because I'll throw my street cred on the table there. I've never seen The Shining, and I was never a huge Stephen King fan.
Oh.
So... Was it a good sequence? Great. Was I missing anything you should have really enjoyed this? I saw the two little girls.
Yeah.
Well, so you met. So did you know the elevator was going to open with blood?
No, but it doesn't surprise me because it's Stephen King.
Yeah, because we knew. I mean, we knew exactly what was going to happen when H was like, "Oh, I'm going to try this." We're like, "Oh my god!"
Okay. So I'll put this in terms that we all understand.
I like that part. Yeah,
I enjoyed it. I was just mad that it wasn't the stuff in the book. But that's a line in the sand that I shouldn't have drawn. I get that. But to go back to improv, when you set up something that you know the audience is going to get, and then you do it anyway, that kind of thing, when you sort of softball it to them to make them feel smart.
Yes,
that's what that sequence was.
In the audience,
you've seen the Shining. It's like. She's going to turn, it's a naked lady in a bathtub is going to turn old and scary.
Yeah.
The two little girls are going to, their elevator is going to open full of blood. But H doesn't know this stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're like, it's the horror movie. Don't open the door, man.
Yeah, and I completely forgot about that whole horror sequence that's not in the book.
Nope.
Okay, now you've just put off this movie being watched by my kids by another year.
Yeah. That sequence is a little rough.
Yep.
But it sort of tried to do all of the disparate types
Honestly, I thought that was much better than the first gate bit.
War Games?
Yeah. And that, in the book, that's like a page at the most.
Yeah.
I don't think they even reference.
And I'm glad it wasn't, because it would have been so tedious for him to like go through every, you know, to spend more time on recreating steps in the movie.
Yes.
That's fine. They also removed a lot of the overhead of needing to be semi-familiar with stuff. Way more people are going to know The Shining than Black Panther, the video game, which I still don't know, even though it's a major sequence in the book. And turning the first, what's the first adventure to get the first key is Dungeons and Dragons?
It's called Adventure.
No, that's the last one.
Okay.
The Dungeons and Dragons quest that he figures out first. Like, all that's taken out and replaced with a race, with King Kong.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not only with King Kong, though.
Simplified.
Ties into another point. There was King Kong, but there's also a dinosaur, which...
In that race?
I'm pretty sure, wasn't there a dinosaur like chomping up at the cars? So you had like a brief moment where it looked like Jurassic Park
with
the dinosaur
chase. Oh, I heard that Spielberg wanted nothing of his old movies in there, but then they kept... You told me that, right?
And I think, they kept on trying to squeeze...
His people were sneaking them in without him knowing, because, he's not going to oversee every...
And see, we're getting into what the people who love the movie will get out of it, which is rewatching it 20 times to see frenetic. All the bits and...
Yeah.
And there's that... Oh, there's Serenity again. There. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where you had, here's the keys to the kingdom. Here's all these Disney and Warner Brothers cartoon characters that you can reference. But does the reference itself advance anything, or is it just there to be a spot in the background?
If there was a dinosaur, I missed it. You could be entirely right.
Well, this is where I hopped up in my soapbox, though, because I disagreed with that choice. If either one of you were Spielberg, the director... known for your beloved movies, wouldn't it make sense? I get that he didn't want everyone to think, this is just going to be a reference medley.
Of myself.
But it was a reference medley.
I think he made the wrong call.
Yeah. That's I agree. Let's throw
in more of his movies. Let's make him actually be one of the characters at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And say, this is the Steven Spielberg presents Ready Player One. I personally would have received that a lot better than this is Ready Player One, the movie. As based on by the book.
Where was E.T.?
Yeah,
or reference to the E.T. the video game.
Yes.
Okay, that'd be great. That'd be double geek points for its awfulness.
I think it might have actually been referenced in the book. It was one of the cartridges lying around.
It was. Yes. It was. Yep. But Jaws, that was the 80s, right? Yeah, there were some missed opportunities that Spielberg drew a line in the sand that I agree was not... I understand he was trying to make it, it's not my ego, but this, if anything... The reason I thought you'd be a good director was because of the work you did in the 80s that is important to the story.
If anybody could have gotten away with it, it would have been the guy that has all the Amblin Studios. Mm-hmm. So, when there's the big adventure scene and all of the Oasis community thing on IOI, show the kids on the bikes with E.T.'s head sticking out.
There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. That scene had no impact to me whatsoever in the movie.
It also had Twisted Sister instead of Rush.
Well, yeah.
I mean, nothing against Twisted Sister, but that was one of those things where they were making interesting musical choices to say, this is how we're going to rise up, and we're going to rise up with this quintessentially 80s...
Like punk and anarchy, wasn't it like an anti-establishment?
Oh, yeah. We're not going to take it.
That seemed like a fine choice. I didn't have any problem with that.
No, but when they had referenced Rush in the book, even if it was just a throwaway, it makes sense. When they referenced Rush in the trailer... They're playing Tom Sawyer, which does get you kind of amped.
I would prefer Tom Sawyer.
Because it's the most recognizable Rush song.
But it's not in the movie, right?
It was in the trailer? They didn't have... And that was with the trailer, and maybe we're getting spoiled now, you're so used to seeing what's in the movie on the trailer.
The trailers have been misleading me with music for a long time. Hmm. I will say that. Like, Kasabian was in where there was, the movie The Beach. I remember the trailer was a live song, and it didn't make it into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
We're running pretty long, so I do want to kind of tie it up. So,
sure.
Let me just go around the room, if we will. So, Smike, book or movie? I know you haven't finished the book. If you had to pick one, Desert Island style, which would it be?
If I had to go through one again?
If you had to suffer through one again, Smike.
Probably the book, but it's a close call.
Okay. Dan?
I would say book or movie, book, and I'll follow that up with very interesting to see with Klein being such a force behind the movie, is he setting this up for a franchise? Is there more story to be told in the world of Oasis, or is it one and done?
Given the depth of the movie, I would say no, but I mean, maybe. I'm very clear. I obviously prefer the book way more than the movie. Dan, is there anything you want to plug, anything you want to talk about, any causes? You already kind of gave a shout out to someone.
I've been very... liberal with my friends and certainly a buddy, Steve Amico. Another time I come back, I'll tell you his story about Dee Snider and Twisted Sister. Other than that, if we're going to plug a cause, the JDRF walk in Buffalo is coming up. I want to say it's June 10th. My daughter has dealt with it since age six. Tremendous cause. A lot of people deal with it. And to the extent that someone hears this and is inspired to go click and support somebody, hey, great. If someone's just inspired to get their kid checked out at a checkup day, test the blood sugar to avoid missing something to the diagnosis, that's good too. I'm going to hop off my soapbox now.
Great. I do want to put one other call out there. So this was episode 3 of our guest fest. And I have actually booked our next couple of guests already. So we're kind of keeping this going. But there is I need to put a call out for those listening. Do you have questions about sleep? Do you have questions about the myths about sleep? Are you a bad sleeper and have a specific question? Do you not know how to choose a bed? Anything like that? Any kind of sleep habits? What are good sleep habits? Do you have any of those kinds of questions? Hit me up on Facebook or email me or text me if you know me, because you probably do, because only my friends listen to this podcast at this point, and maybe Dan's friends for these episodes. Send us your questions about sleep. We will have a long-standing member of the sleep community who is certified person who has conducted many, many hundreds of sleep studies and scored them, knows a lot about this stuff. It's my wife, spoiler alert, who I finally convinced to come on the podcast after years.
That's pretty awesome.
But we would love to have some questions. She loves talking about sleep and really knows a lot. She's not a doctor. She's not going to prescribe or diagnose anything, but she can come close. So send me your sleep questions. Send Buddies in Space your sleep questions if you'd love to have it. We are Buddies in Space. You are?
S. Michael Smith. You are?
M. Michael Carassi. And joining us was?
Special guest, Dan Saper.
Oh, you special guested yourself.
I'm special.
Take it away, Melanie.
Buddies in Space is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. Visit StolenDress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books.
I just got
One thing I forgot to bring up. It was very prescient in the book that he mentioned. After a certain time, because people were given the ability to vote online in elections, it was only celebrities.
That was weird. Yeah, yeah, that was very, yeah, you're right. That was very.
And that was, that's a little on the nose now, isn't it?
I could see the world of Oasis living comfortably inside of Mike Judge's Idiocracy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. We're close. I feel like we could be there. Although I'm not sure VR is ever going to take off the way people hope it does.
Well, I picked up less on VR and more of being an outsider looking in on the whole notion of massive multiplayer online RPGs, where World of Warcraft, you'd have people that would sign in and wouldn't go adventuring. They were just there for the social aspect.
Well, there was the first online millionaire, or the first video game millionaire was like Second Life.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Virtual real estate, like just building storefronts and selling microtransactions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they get into that in the book, especially. Like, that's a way of life for a lot.
The pieces are coming together already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just slow. But I think it's more augmented reality. The Pokemon Go.
That's the nail on that.
That's the thing that caught on more, because it sort of blended the two.
And for a very dark version of that, I'm picturing the Borg from Star Trek. Where everyone's going to have their Google Glass or whatever Facebook rolls out with or something, where we only see the outside of the Borg saying you will be assimilated. What are they doing on the other side of the screen?
It's all unicorns and rainbows. Eat my brain.